Are transsexuals banned from owning land?
Yes.
Is that a law?
What I'm saying is that in the United Kingdom, we need a law that, hold on, I'm trying to figure out how to get some spiked online money.
That
You know,
bans
like,
trans people from owning land. Is that what you're saying, Esri?
well, no, is that we need to replace the royal family with trans people so that they own all the land. I hear a lot that, you know, you have to pay fealty to the trans rights movement. And I'm thinking that would be a pretty good idea because in Britain, you already have to pay fealty, right? But you have to pay them to some inbred people, right?
Not
You
true
should just.
queens.
That's what I'm saying. We pay
Yeah.
to the true. They don't have the inbred problem, but that's not a problem. So if you're going to pay fealty to someone, right? I think it's the only way to make Britain work at this point.
Yeah.
We have to retain landed property, but have the British pay literal fealty to trans people instead of the metaphorical fealty that they take so much umbrage with. I think it would solve everything.
Hello, and welcome to part 32 of our Understanding Class series. Today is Monday, the 26th of February, 2024, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. We finish our discussion of Chapter 9, Is the Precariat a Class? This week, I have the new patrons, Bruce, Holden Mercurio, Gabrielle Cousin, and the returning Victor Trenchard to thank. If you'd like to help support the show, please head on over to the Patreon, where you get access to all those Patreon-only episodes and the Discord server. Apologies again for the reduction in output on the podcast recently. It's a combination of a couple of delays in ranging some episodes that have kind of fallen through, and trying to concentrate on writing the book. It's actually full steam ahead at the writing at the moment, and we've recently finished another major chapter. And hopefully another one will be finished in the coming week or two. If you'd like to help support us in the writing of the Socialist Planning book, myself and Donal are doing, head on over to the Classless Society in Motion.com. I'm also planning to do a new reading group of The Civil War in France by Marx. So if you're interested in participating, please hit me up through the Discord, email, Twitter, or Patreon, or whatever way you want to contact me. It's a short text, so it'll probably only take maybe 4 to 6 recording sessions to complete. I'm hoping to do it every Sunday evening, London time, starting perhaps in April. It should be an interesting read and not a very big commitment to sign up to. So if you are interested, please do hit me up and let me know if you would like to participate in the reading group. Anyways, as ever, the link to the slides for this episode are in the show notes. Okay, to the discussion.
This week we're continuing talking about the precariat and whether it's a class or not. Kyle, how do you feel about taking this first slide? I don't think we did this one last week, so let's just give it a quick go over in case we didn't.
Fair enough. Okay. The precariat's place in class analysis. If we accept the idea that objectively definable material interests are a legitimate criteria for differentiating class locations, the next question becomes how to specify these interests with respect to the class structure of contemporary capitalism. This will help us answer the question of whether the precariat and the working class are distinct classes. For this task, it will be useful to use the game metaphor introduced in the discussion of the Gruski-Whedon model of microclasses. The objective material interests of any location in a capitalist system can be specified at the level of the game itself, at the level of the rules of the game, and as moves in the game. The level of the game itself. The Marxist question is this: how would the material interests of people differently located within capitalism be affected by a change of the game from capitalism to socialism? Some reject the idea of socialism as a viable alternative to capitalism, or argue that it is possible almost everyone would be worse off, and so there is no class differentiation within capitalism at the level of the game. This means that all class locations have shared material interests against socialism. Probably those national conservative types you were talking about, Tom. Given the obvious complexity of modern class structures, how can we clearly specify the interests of people located within the existing economic structure with respect to an alternative as abstract as socialism? Solving this problem has been the central preoccupation of Wright's work on class. Wright has proposed the concept of, quote, contradictory locations within class relations as a way of connecting the complexity of class structures within capitalism to the alternative of socialism. The basic idea is to identify a series of locations within the class relations of capitalism that were in some sense simultaneously dominated and dominating, or exploiting and exploited. In the present context, this implies that with respect to material interests defined in terms of the games of capitalism versus socialism, such locations have contradictory interests. Interests pointing in opposite directions.
Yeah, like one thing I think that like they kind of leave out in this analysis of just contradictory interests or, you know, these contradictory locations within class relations is just kind of like the idea of risk. Like, you know, there's a huge risk associated with trying to go to a new mode of production, as in you might get yourself killed or your house could get burnt down, or you could have to go fight in a war, or, you know, any one of many very negative things that could happen to people. And, you know, this is a major obstacle to a revolutionary movement. It nearly seems to me why, you know, revolutionary movements are actually attached to war so much is that, like, all the bad shit has nearly happened to some extent, and people just say, well, let's have something else. What do people think? It does seem to be quite missing from the book, as far as I can see.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it doesn't quite fit into this question of dominated, dominating, or exploiting and exploited, because you can simply lose out in absolute terms outside of the relationship, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose it's close to that second point there about, like, all class... that it's possible almost everybody would be worse off, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, but I think that it's subtly different, right? Because the point there is that everyone would be worse off under socialism, and not that everyone would be worse off as a result of the transition to socialism, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, which is, this is, of course, discussed in later chapters, and we'll get into what Wright thinks about socialism versus the transition to socialism and what the game theory of that is. But I think it's fair to say that he's, you know, trying to position the contradictory class location jargon as a reason why that, like, people can have sort of conflicting interests, but, like, overall have a, just overall have, like, a location and, like, it within, like, a complex economy. And yeah, it doesn't shake out into the binary very easily all the time. It's like not that helpful. And it's also like, look, I used to be a Maoist. It is a necessary like concept if you're going to have some kind of like two binaries of class relation, some sort. Like you have to be like, yeah, reality is also really complex and shit. So I'm not really sure. I think Wright is like starting to answer the people that think it's possible everyone would be worse off in socialism. Like this is the beginning of his answer.
Yeah, fair enough.
Does anybody want to hear the car registration number plate I saw today? I managed to take a photo of it, but it was kind of obscured. There was a bird shit on the windscreen when I was driving.
I'm not sure.
There was a car in front of me. There was a car in front of me today that had the number plate X88 Mao. So that's like, oh, yeah. X Heil Hitler Mao. Like, I don't know if it's random. Like, wow. Who's coming up with that crazy?
That doesn't sound random.
No.
Well, we can note that I think it was as of today The last opposition party in Hong Kong was finally disbanded. The progressive bourgeoisie, the liberal bourgeoisie party, gave up in the face of police brutality. Or, I don't know, probably not brutality against them so much as just the impossibility of doing anything.
Standing against the proletarian dictatorship?
I mean, that would be one way to describe it, I guess.
It's clearly the most scientifically correct way, comrade.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the glorious socialist future will be delivered by police brutality.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep, same as it ever was.
You know, I'm starting to understand why Mao and HH are on the same plate. Or, I'm sorry,
8-8. 8-8, yes. X-8-8, oh, space M-A-O, M-A-0. That was what M-A-0. It was. Yeah. Okay, next slide. I'll take this one then. The level of the rules of the game. The problem of class interests concerns which set of rules governing capitalism are optimal for different locations within capitalism, given capitalism is the game. Are the American, Dutch, Danish, or Chinese rules superior for manual industrial workers? What about the highly educated workers like doctors or engineers? Do different rules of the capitalist game confer particular advantages or disadvantages on people in different locations within the system? These questions can be asked for the large-scale variations in the rules of capitalism, example, neoliberal / social democracy welfare state, and for second-order variations in the rules. The point is, we can define material... What does it mean there, the second-order variation in the rules? It's just smaller. Okay, yeah. The point is, we can define material interests and thus the nature of the locations of people in a class structure with respect to such variations in the rules of capitalism and not simply over the game of capitalism itself. Okay, so we've kind of hit this stuff before, haven't we? There's no point really going any further into it, is there? Okay. And Esri, how do you feel about doing then this one, the level of moves in the game?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. Just a moment.
Did you materialize from?
Yeah, from
away team transporter.
Yeah, absolutely. That wasn't like an alert or something. That was definitely what it sounded like. The precariat's place in class analysis, the level of moves in the game, the problem of class interests concern the optimal strategies people face in securing and improving their material interests, given that the rules themselves cannot be changed. The problem each person faces in their own specific position is this. In terms of my material interests, what should I do, given that I am in my current position? Should I try to move into a different kind of position, become a different kind of player? Should I get more training to improve my bargaining position in my current location? Should I join with other people like me in collective action for mutual improvement? And if so, who are the other people like me for this task? Using this metaphor of capitalism as a game, we can turn to the question of whether the precariat is a distinct class from the working class. Just how different are the material interests of people in the precariat and in the working class with respect to the games itself? With respect to the game itself, the rules of the game, and moves within the existing game. At the level of the game itself, the precariat and the working class clearly occupy the same position, the same location within the class structure. The material conditions of people in both locations would be enhanced in a socialist economy. However, since the collective struggle for such an alternative is not presently on the political horizon, class divisions at the level of the rules of the game and moves in the game may be more immediately relevant to the question, is the precariat a class? In terms of rules of the game, it is certainly clear that under the existing rules, neoliberal capitalism, the material conditions of life of most people in all three segments of the precariat are worse than most people in the working class. But does this mean that the changes in the rules of the game that would significantly improve conditions for the precariat would adversely affect the material conditions of the working class? And are there changes in the rules that would benefit the working class, but would worsen worsen conditions for the precariat? Are they on the same side of the fence or on opposite sides? Standing proposes the precariat charter, which includes 29 articles, demands for improving the conditions of the precariat. These are all solid progressive proposals that would make a tremendous difference in the lives of people in the precariat. But these proposals do not go against the material interests of the working class, and nearly all of them would significantly advance the interests of workers. This is not true for everyone in capitalism. Standing's plutocratic elite would certainly lose out if these reforms were enacted. The same would be true for much of the salariat, especially for the well-paid segments of the corporate hierarchy. They would also interfere with some of the advantages of the proficients. If we use the 19 articles of the precariat charter as a diagnostic test of class locations with respect to rules of the game, the precariat and the working class are parts of the same class.
Do you want to have a, let's read out. I'll read out a few of these precariat charter.
Sure.
Article 1, redefine work as productive and reproductive activity. Not sure what that means. Reform labor statistics.
I know what it means. So, well, like, you know, reproductive activity is stuff that...
Is
usually left out of the circuits of, you know, productive value, but is actually essential for, you know, producing value in the economy. Different economists have different ways of constructing what production actually is. But, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, no, I was thinking of like reproduction and just like reproducing the economy in the general sense, but not in like, you know, paying women for childcare, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, reform labor statistics, make recruitment practices brief encounters, bizarre, regulate flexible labor, promote associational freedom, reconstruct occupational communities, that's Articles 6 through 10. Articles 11 through 15 are stop class-based migration policy. Stuff like this. Stop demonizing the disabled. Stop workfare now. Decommodify education. Make a bonfire of subsidies. Move towards a basic income, etc., etc. So
the commons. Deliberative democracies. Remarginalized charities, which I thought was the...
Yeah, fuck a charity.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not even joking.
They need to be remarginalized, according to our article. what is remarginalized charities?
I guess, like, stop relying on nonprofits to fill the gaps left by the state.
Yeah, like, it's been sort of like a, like, Tory social engineering hobby horse to fill social service niches with charities wherever they can. So I think it's just like, yeah, maybe we don't need those, actually.
Specifically, like, faith-based charities. Catholics have a belief in... Like, some more politically minded Catholics, like, will have debates around, like, whether justice can be accomplished through charity or through, you know, some kind of socialism or social democracy.
I think what you're thinking of, Kyle, is the big society, no?
I am, yes. I am thinking of the big society. It was like a David Cameron thing, right?
Super large. The big society entailed cutting people's benefits and letting the disabled die. That's essentially...
Huge. Huge society.
Very big.
Look at the size of that society.
Wait, didn't David Cameron fuck a pig?
He fucked a pig. Yeah,
he did also fuck a pig. Yeah.
Well, that's a terrible thing to call his wife, you know, in fairness.
Wait, is that pig the big society?
The pig society?
The pig society.
Yes, it was.
Does David Cameron get horny watching The Wall? I don't know.
Have you seen that episode of Black, whatever it's called? What's that?
No, but we all know about that episode of Black Mirror because there was that tweet about that episode of Black Mirror. And someone watching it in, you know, the good old days was just like, huh, it would be wild if David Cameron fucked a pig, wouldn't it?
Like, oh yeah,
and then all of a sudden it started blowing up, and there's like a new tweet response. Why is everyone retweeting this? Has David Cameron fucked the pig?
It's very funny. You should watch it. It's actually really good, that episode. A lot of the Black Mirror ones I didn't like too much, but that one was goddamn hilarious. Nothing like a bit of bestiality to make me laugh. Now, So going on the previous slide, so basically they're making the case, essentially is that like the precariat and the working class have the same essential class interests. So they are essentially a part of the same class. That's what that previous slide is saying. Is that correct? Am I?
Yeah.
Well,
this is a better argument than I remember it being.
Right.
So let's go to the back of his book about the precariat being a separate class and look at all the things that are good for the precariat. All right, well, let's say we do all this stuff. Does the proletariat have antagonistic interests or basically the same? Well, would all, if we did all this stuff in the back of the precariat charter, in the back of the book about this new class, does it hurt them? Does it hurt the greater proletariat or does it help them? Or not even the greater proletariat, but the, quote, working class, quote, as defined in the book. And no, it pretty much helped them. So they kind of have aligned interests, I guess.
Let me just put on my...
I think that's a pretty good argument.
Let me just put on my dumb bimbo hat and also my devil's advocate hat. Two hats.
Is it not, not the same hat? No?
They are, but we don't want to talk about that.
No way. Like, there's a certain type of person that doesn't need to play devil's advocate.
That is a bimbo, that's true.
And they're much better than the devil's advocate.
Yes. The devil's advocate hat is worse than the bimbo hat, but I'm putting on both.
What would the devil's bimbo hat look like?
Oh, that's... You have to pay extra for that.
I don't know if we can say okay.
That OnlyFans? Is that OnlyFans?
That's OnlyFans, yeah.
Shit.
So, why does it matter if the precariat and the working class have aligned interests or not? Couldn't the precariat just be a separate class that has similar interests to the working class?
So couldn't the precariat have similar interests and be something different?
Yes.
But I think that would mean that they're like the way he's defining class as in their interests, material interests align, is that they're in the same class. You know, if there are no differences, is that not what he's saying? Like if the precariat and the working class, as they define it, had exactly the same material interests in all these different directions, they're essentially just two components of the same class.
Well, he does also...
You know, you could say left-handed workers and right-handed workers, right? And define them as classes, but you would then say, well, they align in all these different things, so essentially they're the same thing. They're all the same part of the same class.
Right, it's a needless division.
No, but there's a much more powerful... There's much more powerful... I mean, first of all, no, there's nothing about having interests that go the same direction that make you exactly the same class. But also, in the book, there's, you know, a bunch of stuff that helps the nominal working class, which doesn't help the precariat and locks them out of employment. And that's the whole reason the book exists.
I see. So
Fair point. Yeah.
So perhaps there is a case to be made that either it's like a subclass or maybe it is a different class, is what, based on what you just said, Esri.
There's totally a case to be made. You know, you could say it's like a labor aristocracy thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And that having a union as it's actually, you know, like a privilege essentially. And
or check your privilege, unionized workers.
It's not a joke here.
No, I know some people think this way.
No, but I'm just saying, like, this is, you know, it's a live way of doing things. And I guess maybe this is why I thought this argument was like, okay. Like, but you know, is that it doesn't actually totally address like a fundamental relations of production thing as much as it could. So I think even on a level of relations of production or something, like if you have some sort of like legal guarantee, then you have a, you know, kind of a bigger political economic advantage in some respects. Like, I think it's kind of undeniable. That's kind of like, I would have preferred, you know, that kind of differentiation on the level of relations of production and all that kind of shit. I'm not sure like this totally defeats the argument, but you know, it is kind of a fun argument to just go to the back of the book and be like, if we did this, you know, it does still help the working class. It doesn't cut against them like it would with the salariate or the proficients or the, you know,
elite plutocrats.
Yeah, like a octopus elite or whatever he calls it in the book. Sorry.
The globalists.
It is. It does kind of, yeah.
It reads like that, yeah.
Don't but, talk to the globalists, goddamn.
But, but okay, so maybe to kind of punch up, or maybe not even punch up, but zero in the counter argument, maybe it's better to say that what Eric, what Wright accomplishes in this chapter is not completely taking down Sending's argument, but rather maybe like cutting it down a little bit, saying that, well, there's so much overlap between the interests of the precariat and the working class that semi, like focusing them as like a distinct class may or may not be true, but it's not, they're not, their interests are so aligned that they'd be better off working together. Even if the working class, as defined in Sending's book, does have some advantages over the precariat. Because this book, what's interesting about Sending's book is that there is this kind of phenomena of workers who have like a union or just like have like a good stable income and employment versus people, a lot of people who just don't have that, who go from job to job, who are very precarious. I personally don't think that constitutes a separate class, but there is something to that difference. Living on both sides of that, you know, myself.
Oh yeah, well, it's a huge difference. It's just like, yeah, I think we went over last time how much this concept of this way of carving things up is overly historical, like overly invested in our sort of like a historical understanding of what the working class was and how people in the precariat now aren't the working class. Because, you know, the working class is when you have like a union and there's like a big world war and you have to stop the Nazis. It's not actually like capitalism is so much older than that. The historical working class is more like the precariat, where it's all atomized and kind of fucked and doesn't have its own institutions most of the time.
Right.
It just is. It's so much more like that most of the time. And I guess what Eric Olin Wright achieves here is the old Marxist maneuver of, you know, sorry, snowflake, there are two genders, you know, proletariat and bourgeoisie. Like, with class analysis, this is
it's so true, though.
This is the Marxist go-to move. And Wright is basically saying, like, if when it comes down to it, you know, what's okay. Maybe what's good for the working class, you know, narrowly constructed in this labor aristocratic kind of sense, is not good for the precariat. But what's good for the precariat is good for the working class, yeah. Narrowly constructed. And because of that, they're basically on the same side of the fence. It's very literally like a binary reductionist argument. They're on the same side of the fence.
Right. Well, perhaps to sharpen our analysis a little bit, there may be more than two classes, more than the two genders, perhaps. But
yeah,
there are poles around which their interests are more or less aligned.
Right.
And
yeah,
they're better off working together on each side of those poles, near those poles, or on each side of those fences.
Because like, hang on, Tom. Because Wright does not say that the interests of the salariat and the interests of the the proficients do coincide with the precariat and the quote unquote working class in that neatly binary way, right? He doesn't make that argument. He doesn't say that those are actually identical as well.
Right.
No, not at all. Like, and if anything, in his discussion of the precariat charter, they would sort of be on the
opposite side.
They have enough like labor aristocratic elements to actually be on the other side, which is kind of a stark set of claims.
What class is slime mold in? That's the key
slime
question.
Mold. Slime mode is in a contradictory class location. Next question.
It's in 600 classes. Okay, the Sophia, let's read this slide, because I think this kind of sums up some of the stuff we've just been talking about.
All right. The Procariot's place in class analysis. The diagnosis becomes somewhat more complicated when we ask if there are other significant changes in the rules of the game that would advance the interests of most people in the working class, but would be harmful for the Procariot. For example, would changes to employment law that would increase job protections for workers by making it harder for workers to be laid off have the side effect of harming the Procariot? Would legal changes in the U.S. that would make unionization easier by rejecting the anti-union strategies of employers harm the Procariot? There are some ambiguities here. These types of rule changes could have the effect of deepening the dualism in the labor market and making it harder for those in a Procariot to move into more stable jobs. It is also possible, depending on the details of such changes, that they could increase the number of precarious jobs relative to stable jobs. These ambiguities are a basis for considering the Procariot to be a distinct segment of the working class at the level of the rules of the game. Different segments of a class share the same general interests over the optimal rules of the game within capitalism, but differ in the relative priority of potential changes in the existing rules, and may have opposing interests over specific rules in certain historical contexts. Another possibility is to argue that these tensions between the Procariot segment of the working class and some of the rest of the working class reflect a specific kind of contradictory location within class relations in 21st century capitalism. The idea here would be that those workers who still actually have enforceable rights to their jobs, the most secure, if dwindling, part of the working class, have a kind of limited property right that normally is associated with owning the means of production. The right to fire an employee. They can quit, but they cannot be fired. In this way of framing the problem, much of the Procariot is firmly in the working class, while the most securely protected workers occupy a privileged contradictory class location. It kind of solves that.
Yeah.
Right. So he's defining them as a segment due to like the fact that they only differ in the specific rules of the game with respect to their material.
They differ in how they would prioritize moves in the game. Right. They have different rankings of preferences relative to each other. Even though overall they share the same class interest.
But he also says may have opposing interests over specific rules in certain historical contexts as well, Kyle.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Enough with this neoclassical preference, fucking ordinal preferences. I have to read enough of this shit for the calculation debate.
Calculation debate. He does try to bring it in there. It was in there.
It's part of how he thinks. Definitely. I mean, you know, this also makes sense of what's being said. I don't know if there's really an argument against splitting this off into its own class. You know, like, here's another way of making sense of it. This is a little, you know, if you want to, if your intuition is to have fewer classes than rather than more, why don't you just fold these two in?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is, like, if you look at this, like you were saying, from the, like, relations of production perspective, it would be quite hard to make the argument that they are different classes. But again, yeah, that's not right. The approach he takes in this chapter.
Right.
Right. I just kind of really dislike the idea of calling, like, this privileged sector of the working class the working class. I just kind of despise that way of muddying the general relations in society, you know?
Yeah, but you can't talk about this book's ideas without trying to represent that somehow.
Yeah. Right, but, you know, you could call it like the, you know, unionized working class or you know, the privileged sector or something that's not just the working class. Because in reality, like, if you look at back the time when Marx is writing Capital and all that kind of stuff, like, the vast majority would have been in the precariat, right? They weren't unionized or anything.
Whatever the precariat is in, you know, the 19th century, because it's supposed to be this highly historicized category, and
I don't know if I agree with the precariat framing per se, but I think we need to talk about this distinction between more secure workers and less secure. And the more secure workers in reality is the more historicized segment of the working class. That wasn't around before. That came around, and now the unique situation we're in now is that that is being dwindled away. That's the unique thing, not the precariat. They've been around since forever.
Yeah.
Yep.
Kyle, do you want to take this final slide?
All right. So what about class locations defined with respect to moves in the game? Perhaps the precariat and the working class could be considered distinct classes, if thought of as microclasses, as proposed by Grusky and Whedon. When class is specified exclusively in terms of the optimal moves to realize material interests under the existing rules of the game. Two problems arise with this proposal. The first, the working class itself ceases to be, quote, a class if we restrict the specification of class to moves in the game. The interests of workers located in different sectors and occupations can easily diverge sufficiently to create lines of demarcation so long as interests are defined with respect to moves in the game rather than rules of the game. Number two, the precariat itself is internally divided into distinct categories at this level of analysis, as Standing himself acknowledges. What we are left with then is that the precariat is either a part of the working class, if class is analyzed in terms of the basic rules of the game in 21st century capitalism, or it is itself an aggregation of several distinct class locations, if class is defined narrowly in terms of homogeneous interests defined by moves in the game. The precariat, as a rapidly growing segment of the working class and the bearer of the sharpest grievances against capitalism, may have a particularly important role to play in struggles over the rules of capitalism and over capitalism itself, but it is not a class in its own right. If class analysis is to help us develop a coherent, consistent way of theoretically understanding social cleavages and the possibilities of transformation, the concepts we use should have precise meanings that illuminate the nature of shared and conflicting interests and potential collective capacities. For these purposes, treating the precariat as a class obscures more than it clarifies.
So what do people think about that? Do you think this is the correct way to go about defining a class?
I mean, this isn't exactly how microclasses was used before. It'd be more like bundles of microclasses, right? Like, because microclasses are sort of at the professional level.
But, like, yeah, isn't this just like a very specific, this is like a very specific definition of microclasses?
I guess so.
That is, like, peculiar to Grusky and Whedon.
Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah, optimal moves to realize interest in the existing rules of the game. That's right.
Yeah, so like that seems quite dodgy because like you would, like there's that issue, as he says, that like you kind of get to like of sort of like bad infinity of class division.
Right.
Where you could like Zeno's paradox your classes down to infinitely small class identities.
Yeah.
But also it seems like it would be really like problematic over time because like your classes would probably be like more chaotically composed than would be recognizable to the people in the classes, right? Like it wouldn't be, they'd be class definitions that would only be of interest to economists, I think, as opposed to like even like sociologists or just people trying to make sense of what's the power distribution in the society. Like it feels like it would be something done purely out of a kind of like obsession with like this methodology, more so than like something useful.
Yeah, I guess he's trying to just not dismiss it out of hand. Does seem like a stretch.
Yeah. So like the previous definition that we had in the previous slide differed from this because it was about what? Like sort of like the idea that there are class interests over time as opposed to like purely like an optimization problem of like what is the best next move. Is that kind of the difference? Because it sounds like Wright is saying that this is a different definition than the one we saw in the last slide.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think it's about this is more of an observation problem, whereas before, like, let's talk about class interests as far as like changing the game or changing the rules of the game.
Well, this is also about the moves in the game, rules of the game distinction. Were we also in the game metaphor last time?
We were, yeah.
Yeah, we were, but it was about the rules, and this is purely about the moves.
Yeah, this is purely about the moves. Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. I get it now. Yeah, where it's like you don't take changing the rules to be a move in the game. It's just these are the rules, they exist. Within that constraint, what is your optimal solution? Okay,
yeah,
got it.
Categorization based on moves rather than rules. Yeah.
Okay. Are we happy with the we've shoveled the precariat into its proper place? Anything outstanding for us to discuss about the precariat? I found this one of the least interesting chapters in the entire book, I must say. What were people's generals?
There's some like theoretically interesting questions that this is related to. You know, the specific question of the precariat is maybe like not nominally like interesting, but like it is like generally kind of an interesting thought. Like, you know, given the political role that workers' movements had in the 20th century, isn't there like a sort of broader layer of the proletariat whose interests that went underrepresented in the 20th century labor movement? I think it's a fascinating, really important question about what Marx probably was hoping the proletariat would mean rather than what it turned out to mean. So it's like really like right next to and related to a very important question. It's just, you know, maybe not the most penetrating analysis I've seen of it.
Yeah, the problem with this chapter isn't so much the problem that the precariat theory is trying to solve, but rather focusing on the precariat theory itself. It's just of its time, and it's not something you see people talk about much anymore. I don't see, at least.
Because there have been unionization movements in the precariat.
Yes.
No, it's true.
That's kind of like the working class, a little bit.
Right, and so like, where are they? Are the Starbucks workers who like just formed a union? Like, are they now working class?
Well,
like,
I mean, I guess this, you know, would Starbucks workers have always been working class in this framework? Because they have like,
is that stable employment?
I don't know.
Employment? Yeah.
Why not? Let's ask X88 MAO MA0.
Oh, that guy thinks that everyone in this country is, and all the countries we are in, are all...
All Starbucks baristas are petty bourgeoisie.
Yeah, they're all PB. Yeah. They belong to us. Shot.
I mean, I don't think we honestly need to have, like, a long discussion about, like, whether Starbucks baristas are, like, have stable employment, because, like...
Yeah,
they definitely don't. Like, your hours as a Starbucks barista are completely at the whim of your manager, and they do all kinds of bullshit to screw with you over that. So I think they're definitely, like, in the precariat as it's defined here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm just putting it forward that, like...
But they'll pay for your school.
Like, that's... I don't know. That's a discussion online. Like, it's like a really loud, bad one.
Listen, if you have blue hair and work at a coffee shop, you get the wall. That's it.
No, you can't be... you can't be a worker.
Right.
Because... You're culturally different. Like, you're the wrong kind of worker.
You're the ruling class. Essentially, you're the ruling class if you got blue hair. That's what I've learned.
It's color analysis.
Right. It's the globalists and the blue hair people. They rule the world. That's right.
Is that how we achieve communism? Is everybody gets blue hair and then class domination no longer exists? Only color domination exists?
Yeah, but not skin color, hair color.
Would there be domination?
Yeah, it's voluntary.
The same hair color, though. It would just be, there would be no domination. It'd be uni.
Well, yeah, you would always have the option. You would always have the option to, like, retain your natural hair color, which would put you as an oppressed person, right?
Yeah, that'd be insane.
Listen, the barista at Starbucks refused to have sex with me. She's oppressing me.
That sounded too real, Sophie. That sounded like a true life story.
I mean, that probably is a psychosexual root of a bunch of this, like, weird barista punching online, even though they're, like, one of the only sectors that's like, hey, we used to not have a union, and now we do.
No.
And then you have all these, quote, workerists that are like, no, this doesn't count.
Listen.
Like, why doesn't that count? Why isn't, like, a workerist happy that there's unionization? Like, there must be some deranged psychosexual root. I think you're right about that.
Listen.
I'm not going to vouch for whatever you're about to say. Just look on your face.
I'll vouch for it. Sophie, listen, I'll vouch for it.
Thank you. What I'm about to say is this. Workers are people who align themselves with racists.
Okay, yeah.
To kill all the women at the Starbucks who refuse to have sex with me and get my name wrong in my cup.
Okay, and thanks for coming. We'll see you next week.
I told you. I told you. That was putrid.
If you'd like to help fund the book that Donald and myself are writing about communist economic planning, please head over to the website, theclasslesssocietyinmotion.com, where you can donate to our fund to help us get this book out in a finite time. This show is a member of the Emancipation Network, a Marxist podcast and research collective. Make sure to check out our network sister podcasts, General Intellect Unit and Swampside Chats. And if you'd like to help out the show, please remember to head over to Patreon and throw me a few commie dollar.